From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today we'll learn about the closure of the LGBTQ Center of Southeastern Wisconsin and what questions are still unanswered. Then we'll look at how the risk of flooding has increased due to climate change.
As of now, I think there's just a large amount of unawareness about flood risk, about flood policy options, and about the financial devastation that can occur if a flood event happens at your house.
Plus, we'll speak with a local animal attorney about the cases that he takes on.
All the animal cases I've been involved in, they're often emotionally fraught, very complex at times, but it's kind of assuring as a human to do good things for animals.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. On May 16th, staff at the LGBTQ Center of Southeastern Wisconsin arrived at their building in Racine to find the doors closed, programs canceled, and their accounts disabled. The center served LGBTQ plus youth and adults across Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties. A public statement on their website says that financial issues as well as difficulty navigating the current sociopolitical climate are why they closed. However, the closure was abrupt without any public notice or final appeal for support. To learn more about the closure and to share some updates on this story, I'm joined by Denise Lockwood of the Racine County Eye. Denise, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So on Friday, May 16th, staff at the LGBTQ Center of Southeastern Wisconsin in Racine arrived to find that programs were canceled and staff accounts were disabled. And this was done sort of without any forewarning, right? So can you kind of just walk us through what happened?
Sure. So I got a phone call probably mid-morning saying that a number of the staff were informed that they were no longer employed by the LGBTQ Center of Southeastern Wisconsin, and that they had a group of folks that were protesting that because they had found out the night before, and only through some of the youth that were at a group the night before, the staff had told them that they were no longer going to be meeting and that the center was going to be closing.
Yeah, so less than a full day's notice about. You wrote an article kind of about what unfolded, and in that you spoke with board president Kinzua Lesur, who spoke to some of their mounting problems that led to this unexpected closure. What were some of the main challenges that they pointed to?
Yeah, so the organization, the nonprofit, has been around for quite a few years. They had been expanding quite a bit, especially over the last, I want to say, 2 to 3 years. They had gotten a lot of support from the city of Racine through CDBG funding, through the United Way of Racine County. A number of other foundations had done what's called the segregated funds, which means that they were earmarked for specific programs. And a lot of that programming was continuing to be funded, but they also relied on the community at large from Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties for that funding. And those funds, the individual donor funds, had started to dry up. Mr. Lesur had mentioned that that money was really paramount to their daily operations, meeting the funding of the center itself, not necessarily the programs.
Okay, yeah, because there's a mix of obviously like individual donations, there's federal grants that have an expiration date, but there's also community support and grants as well. But another big factor of this before we kind of go into the money thing is the overall hostility towards DEI initiatives. And right. Obviously it's a nationwide hostility led by the Trump administration currently. But how does this look at the local level in Racine? You know, were they seeing mounting pushback from their community about political and cultural issues?
So I have actually been working on a story about this. This was kind of a flashpoint of what I had been trying to report on for quite a few months. And I've got a much larger story that's brewing. So I was actually talking to the United Way of Racine County, and I spoke to the executive director there, Alexa Brock High. She had mentioned that there's been a lot of public pressure to not necessarily defund, but rename a lot of these programs that they had been working with a lot of nonprofits to make sure that they still did the work. But there's definitely pressure and concern that the Trump administration was going to be targeting a lot of these programs. And so I was asking her how resilient that funding was for nonprofits. And she said, you know, with the LGBTQ Center, they had remained very dedicated to funding them, that they were always going to continue funding them. And they were really surprised that this had happened. And so she was really surprised, but she said that they had just learned that the center was dissolving that day as well, and that that made them very sad. But their funding had remained. So they remained a strong supporter of that work, but a lot of individual donors were also very nervous because of kind of the backlash that the community at large could potentially have against like business owners who were people from the LGBTQ community and what that might do to their businesses. And so that's something that I've been hearing consistently that I'm very much trying to track, especially in Racine. We have a very high population of people in the DEI community. And so it's something that I'm very focused on as a journalist.
So with these community partners like United Way, as you mentioned, they were all caught off guard and all still committed to having financial support towards the LGBTQ Center. And their grants were mainly for programming, not salaries, operations, or rent. So did a lot of this come down to mismanagement?
Well, see, and that's the question that I have. And that's really one of those outstanding questions. From the sense that I got, I don't really have any clear answers. So I want to kind of put that out there. Mr. Lesor basically said, you know, he didn't go into a lot of detail. A lot of the public facing comments were that they just didn't have the operational funding that they needed to continue. And they didn't go into a lot of detail.
To kind of add to that, and a lot of the clarity that's still being sought is with some of the staff that you spoke with. Like, what are they saying? Because they weren't really included in decision making or aware of their financial condition. And one youth coordinator said that the board, the leadership said there was no saving the center. Quote, they gave us nothing. No thank you. No goodbye. So to not include your staff or at least make them aware of the state of things, especially in a nonprofit, just seems, I don't know how I want to say this word, but usually in nonprofits, you're well aware of your fiscal outlook most right. of the time.
Yeah. Well, and actually I spoke to some of the founding partners in this organization, and they were really taken back as well. And there were definitely some things that just didn't set well with the communication. Now I do know that the leadership had just recently changed. Kinswa was just named the executive director in the transitioning of the disillusionment or dissolving of the organization. And he had taken over from Barb Farrar, who had led the organization for a number of years. But I got no comment from her. So there's a lot of unanswered questions still, and I'm still kind of poking around and trying to make sure that I'm showing up and trying to find out what else is going on here.
Right. And just to clarify for our listeners, what was public facing and what's still left to be unanswered?
So they basically had said that their past fundraising hadn't been at the level to address the needs of unrestricted spending, that it's been increasingly difficult for them to navigate the issues and concerns that a lot of the folks that had done donations prior to this. And so that's what they said to me in regards to what happened. So they kept it very light as far as the public facing response, but there's just a lot we don't know. Now, I do know that as I was talking to some of the folks at the center, there are probably about 10, 12 people that were actively protesting. Some of them were staff, and they were really concerned about the youth programming because I spoke to Shay King, They said that there were about 20 to 30 youth that they were actively working with. And one of the heartbreaking things in this was they had been set to have an LGBTQ friendly prom, which had been happening for quite a few years, and that wasn't going to happen.
Right. The equality prom, they had a youth violence prevention program. A lot of youth going there were also going to support groups to stop self-harming. So what other things are now at risk and what voids are left with the abrupt closure of the LGBTQ center?
Yeah. So one of the things that is happening in the background is I did have a really good conversation with Shay. They said that they are forming a new nonprofit called People's Center. The People's Center of Southeastern Wisconsin's queer community moves forward. So basically, they really wanted to make sure that they focused on the needs of BIPOC community members, and they didn't really want to simply revive the broken system that existed. That they wanted to start envisioning a new organization that would prioritize the needs of those who had been left behind, that they wanted to be a resource and support hub for queer communities in Racine and Kenosha, with a special focus on BIPOC, disabled, and otherwise marginalized community members. And they are reforming a new organization. And that's one of the things that they're really focusing on is that structural framework that would allow that to happen.
Well, that's good. A new nonprofit trying to fill the void as a stopgap measure. What other updates can you share regarding either next steps or any additional community response that's been in the Racine area since this closure?
Yeah, so Shay basically said that they're working to secure new spaces with community partners, and they're going to be publishing a calendar that outlines times, dates, and places and locations for reestablishing groups. Once the services are reestablished for Southeast Wisconsin, the highest at-risk youth populations, they plan to launch a new and reimagined services throughout Southeastern Wisconsin. So they're looking for feedback. They're looking for collaboration. There's a new Facebook page called the People's Center, and they are asking people that are interested in getting involved to visit that Facebook group. There's a form that they have put out there that they want to really work on providing more services and communication tools to those communities.
And for now, the assets such as the building and what's happening to that is unclear too, right? Is the pressure right. Still keeping up to get some more clarity and answers from the board that kind of just released that one statement and has kind of gone on their way?
That is one of the things that I am focused on the most in trying to understand what is going to happen next. I do know that Alexa from the United Way is said that they are definitely going to be reaching out to the LGBTQ Center of Southeastern Wisconsin to offer any help that they can offer as far as like the process of dissolving and what happens with those assets, because they have to be legally transferred to another nonprofit. So there's definitely big questions that are still remaining, and Racine County I remains dedicated to covering this.
Well, and I'll be happy to have you back when there's more to report on. But for today, Denise, thank you so much for the update. I appreciate your time.
All right. Take care.
Denise Lockwood is the owner of the Racine County Eye News website. She joined me to share more about her reporting of the closure of the LGBTQ Center of Southeastern Wisconsin. You can find her full article at WUWM.com. What does the future of climate disasters and mitigation look like in Wisconsin? Earlier this year, a group of UW-Milwaukee graduate students partnered with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to find out. Their report, Rising Waters, Rising Costs, looked at how flooding has already impacted Wisconsin residents and what can be done. As a part of our Climate Solutions Week reporting, WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with the graduate students about the report. First, we'll hear from Milwaukee resident Tom Maddox about how he's been impacted by flooding.
How has this neighborhood changed as far as this bioswale? Like, what do you remember being here when you were in business all that time ago?
This here was just open field, flat ground. They had said one time that this was going to be apartments put here, but ended up not apartments. And this used to be a park right here, and they taking the park away and put this back right here because they said that it would be people in the community would be employed at the factory, but I don't know how many people from the community works over there, but yeah, they took that park out of the community.
You know, one of the things we're looking at and talking to people about is flooding. Have you had flooding in your businesses or your house over the years?
I had flooding in my home 10, 11 years or so, somewhere around in that ballpark area. But yeah, my basement flooded real bad. Couldn't go down there no more before I made it to the bottom of the step because the water was just everywhere over there. And I called FEMA, whoever that was, came and they came and, you know, estimated did. And after, I think, a couple of days or so, the water did go down.
Did you have flood insurance at the time?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I got paid, you know, for it. They paid me for my stuff, damage and stuff. But, you know, I'd rather not for it to be damaged because, you know, you get old stuff that you have that some of my grandparents' stuff that I had that, you know, you lose the water, get to it, so you can't recover that type of stuff, you know. Sentimental values, you can't recover.
Are you all ready for your moment?
I think so.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, my best. So my name is Evelyn. I was a second-year student at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And on the report, I worked on the green infrastructure solutions in Milwaukee.
Hi, I'm Cami Armendariz. I am going to be in my second year at UW-Milwaukee as a water policy master's student. And within the report, I was doing flood risk and socioeconomic data mapping.
How's it going? My name is Joe McCormick. I'm also a freshwater policy student at UWM. And in this report, I focused on the overlay of flood insurance with those socioeconomic indicators.
Can you tell me about the impact that flooding has in Wisconsin? What did you all learn about that?
Sure. I mean, flooding is the most common and most costly natural disaster in the state of Wisconsin. And with the effects of climate change, it's expected that more frequent and severe storms are going to increase the amount of flood damage that takes place. So municipalities around Wisconsin are working really hard to shore up their own mitigation techniques. But even if you have the best mitigation techniques, you know, there's still always going to be flood risk, which is why we try to emphasize the adoption of personal flood insurance policies.
What makes an area susceptible to like flood risk or flood damage?
In the city of Milwaukee, it's susceptible to flood damage because there's a lot of impervious surfaces here. And
so like looking around a neighborhood like this where you can see large buildings, abandoned manufacturing, a lot of hard surfaces, very little trees. This would be like a pretty prime example of like impervious surfaces and susceptible to flooding.
Yep, exactly. And within this area, in our report, we looked at the socioeconomic indicators, but a lot of that is areas where it was all hardscape now because of the community and the history of the urbanization of people, I guess.
Socioeconomic mapping.
Yes.
What is it? Why does it matter? And what does it tell us about flooding and how to keep people not wet?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so FEMA has normally like been the historic kind of like landmark figure that delineates 100-year floodplains, which is kind of what Evelyn was just talking about. And these floodplains tend to have a lot of prior data mapped on them. It's what like local municipalities, other things are kind of relying on when they're trying to prepare for any flooding disasters that are going to happen. But then again, there's a lot of floodplains that aren't actually mapped by FEMA, or the ones that are mapped, just it's old data. It's not really focused on socioeconomic indicators. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong there where municipalities aren't really prepared. So a really important thing is not only to apply like ecological things to when you're mapping for FEMA, but also applying in socioeconomic indicators. And that can range from like, okay, how many people have like diabetes in this area, to a large thing we focus on was like renters and things like that. Cause there's the ability to kind of recover from a big natural disaster changes like drastically whether you own your house or whether you're a renter in terms of the if you got that insurance or anything. Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Harvey were excellent examples that we utilized in our report that really showed how much more renters suffered, and then especially Black and Hispanic populations in the area. So there was one really great project by Groundwork Milwaukee, and I'm forgetting their other partners they were working with, but they specifically focused on Milwaukee as their case study and outlined a ton of socioeconomic indicators, again, ranging from diabetes to how many people are in the household, income, and countless others. I highly recommend reading through their report.
If we're talking about renters, which the majority of Metcalf Park residents are renters, what are some of the insufficiencies when it comes to like flooding insurance and then specifically dealing with renters?
Sure. So we talked earlier about flood zones. Flood zones delineate risk, and they're categorized from X to V, and each different region has a different level of risk. Things that are called SFHAs are Special Flood Hazard Areas, SFHAs. Those are areas where you've got mortgage requirements to have flood insurance. So if you want to get a mortgage and you want it backed by the federal government, you need to have a flood insurance policy. And as a result, that's kind of the only regions where you see widespread adoption of flood insurance policies. There's currently no mandates for standard renters insurance to include flood insurance.
So why would they?
Exactly. And I think a lot of people don't understand their risks. There's been a lot of academic evidence to support the fact that people generally have really poor risk perception. They don't think it'll happen to them. And, you know, traditionally it's been expensive. So flood insurance historically has always been operated by these two levels. It's private, which is relatively new, and the FEMA, National Flood Insurance Program, the NFIP. And the NFIP covers the entire nation, right? It's been around since 1968. It's extremely debt saddled due to these high extreme payout events like Katrina and Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Ida. It's paying hundreds of millions of dollars every year just to pay off its own debt. And, you know, future federal funding looks a little grim. So that's where private insurance needs to step up and offer more customizable options with different price points based on risk. There's a lot more advanced modeling that allows for them to create these more nuanced policies. But as of now, I think there's just a large amount of unawareness about flood risk, about flood policy options, and about the financial devastation that can occur if a flood event happens at your house.
All right, Evelyn, I've got a question, because if we're talking about how do you serve like underserved, underinvested communities, I feel like 30th Street Corridor, this right here in front of us, is an example of that. So can you tell me a little bit about what you learned with the work with MMSD in the 30th Street Corridor?
Yeah, so MMSD is kind of targeting those underserved communities, and infrastructure is really costly to fix over time. So to kind of combat that and take like a better approach, they're also implementing green infrastructure such as bioswales. And those are large stormwater basins that help capture water where it falls and prevent water from going into those pipes and over flooding that system, because then that's going to lead to a sewer overflow, which then dumps mixture of raw sewage and stormwater into Lake Michigan, which we don't want. So this is kind of preventing that from happening. So they kind of just reach out to underserved communities and tell them about the projects that are happening and make them familiar with what's being done in their community, and then also kind of give them strategies that they can help implement, such as small-scale green infrastructure, like rain barrels and rain gardens in their own homes, which they help provide and educate the community on as well.
What surprised you about your study and just going through the data and learning what you did?
For me, at least, when looking at the data, just like the extreme number of like flooding blind spots that are missed in mapping. There's like a lot of flood risk hotspots where like there's significant pluvial flooding, which just means that the drainage systems, again, like Evelyn mentioned earlier, are going to be overwhelmed and these areas are going to be heavily flooded and damaged. So looking at maps where you look at traditional FEMA mapping tools versus when you combine social vulnerability data, you'll see so many more communities that are going to be affected.
Yeah, and I guess I would just add to that, when you look at the insurance adoption, it similarly points to a lot of coverage gaps. FEMA data suggests the fact that over 80% of all residential NFIP policies are held by individual homeowners and not 2 to 4 family residences, which suggests a real lack of coverage for renters and people living in multiple unit buildings.
I'd say just learning about the 30th Street Corridor projects and the basins themselves was super interesting as I kind of focus on the green infrastructure. I believe the West Basin, which is the larger of the three, can capture up to 31 million gallons of water, which is just really hard to even picture in your mind, like how much water that is. So I think that's really neat and cool.
What I'm hoping this story gets to is like the solutions part of everything. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious if there are other parts of the solutions and the takeaways that you all highlighted or featured in the report.
For mine, for people themselves, would be just to look into, like, MMSC offers programs for rain barrels and rain gardens. Just finding out what resources there are for you as a person to try to capture water where it falls and install your own small-scale green infrastructure, because that will help capture water where it falls and prevent flooding and overwhelming of the sewer system.
You should get flood insurance. It's estimated that 1 inch of flood damage can cost $25,000 worth of damage. I don't think people quite understand their risk. I don't think people are fully aware of the financial devastation that can occur with an uninsured flood event. There's a lot of flexible flood insurance packages, and there's a lot of government relief programs that are worth looking into if you're currently uninsured. It's definitely worth exploring. Get flood insurance.
I would say for just organizations, government employees, other officials who are dealing with this and trying to find solutions, make sure you're communicating to the public in a very engaging way, creating visuals that are understandable to the public. Again, Groundwork Milwaukee made like an Esri story map. And if you look at it, the colors are beautiful. Just making something that the general public, someone who knows nothing about flood insurance, who doesn't know what any of these acronyms mean, they can get it and they'll want to keep reading it. So just make it science communication and make it good.
That was UWM School of Freshwater Science graduate students Cami Armendariz, Joe McCormick, and Evelyn Grimm, authors of the report Rising Water, Rising Costs. They spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez for our Climate Solutions Week reporting in partnership with NPR. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson about how the city is preparing to take in climate refugees. You can find more information and reporting for Climate Solutions Week at WUWM.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll speak with a local animal attorney and learn what the job entails. But first, we'll learn about a new initiative in Milwaukee County to try and help out local small businesses and entrepreneurs. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A new initiative aims to help create and expand small businesses in Milwaukee County. The Building Bridges program will provide $10,000 in grants and technical support to qualifying entrepreneurs. It's an effort which Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley says could make a difference during a time of economic uncertainty. WUWM's Eddie Morales is joined by Crowley and Economic Development Director Celia Benton to learn about the Building Bridges program.
This really came out during my State of the County address, and this is when I had the opportunity to really call on my administration to come up with a way that we can build bridges between small businesses, entrepreneurs, as well as the small business support organizations, but also how can we work with municipalities in helping them fill some of their commercial corridor spaces. And so we wanted to take a much stronger approach to supporting small businesses, helping to grow our economy, and really to just provide more opportunities for workers throughout this process. And so that came with WCD dollars that we received, about $200,000 in grant funds. But we also had some funds here within Milwaukee County. And so with the help of Celia, we've created a position, a business liaison position, to help provide technical support and helping those businesses either expand or move into brick and mortar spaces across Milwaukee County. But also in conjunction with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, it gives us an opportunity to provide $10,000 grants as well.
Celia, why is there a need for this program in the community, and what potential solutions does the program provide?
So the first thing I want to say is one thing that County Executive Crawley does a phenomenal job at is leading with partnerships. He gets things done leading with partnerships. And there's a very clear need in my mind from a small business ecosystem for a front door to all of the resources that are out there at a county level. So we, in my opinion, have a wonderful array of ethnic and diverse chambers, community development finance institutions, banks, business improvement districts, et cetera. They all do wonderful work, but there isn't right now a front door where somebody can say, hey, I want to start a business in name the municipality. How do I go about navigating? Where do I get access to capital? Who can help me navigate the process for getting my business plan? Are my financial projections looking good? And how do I navigate the permit process for building out this brick and mortar space that I just love and I want to start my business in? And so for me, the real value add is that we will now be acting as that front door. So again, we're partnering directly with municipalities, thinking about like where are those commercial corridor spaces that you maybe don't have capacity to drive interest, or you want support driving interest around. You'd love to see them activated. Can you help me bring some vetted entrepreneurs from some of our chambers or other technical assistance providers? That is a sweet spot that we'll be able to offer through this program. We'll be helping kind of build these bridges between that ecosystem and the municipalities, leading with partnership, bringing people together and driving that commercial corridor activation while also fueling that entrepreneurship and connecting those dots. And again, that's where the need is. And so as the exec stated, right, it really does come down to a small business liaison, but we'll also be supporting through these grants that he mentioned and some other marketing efforts as well.
David, what concerns are you hearing from the community and small business owners just about the state of the economy and how it's impacted running a business?
You know, I think we're hearing not only in Milwaukee County, but across the state and across the country about the level of uncertainty that folks are seeing in our current economy, right? And whether we're talking about small businesses that rely on supply chains and goods that are coming from overseas, they want to make sure that they can keep their prices low. But when you think about entrepreneurs, when you think about small businesses that are looking to expand and just do more, they're looking for more assistance, more technical assistance. You know, we always see the commercials when they talk about, you know, you're working in the business versus on the business. And sometimes people need, again, that technical support, another level of expertise to figure out how they need to move forward. But also, what's always good is resources and in the form of dollars to help many of these small businesses. And so whether that's helping them with, you know, brick and mortar that we're speaking to, or helping them to upgrade their POS systems or make better connections, you know, on whether or not, like, for example, there may be a business in the city of Milwaukee. How do they expand and open up their and build their capacity to be in a South Milwaukee or in an Oak Creek or in a Bayside or River Hills, right? And so businesses, business owners, entrepreneurs, they see a level of uncertainty and they're looking to, you know, us as elected leaders to figure out what tools can we help provide them to give them a certain level of certainty, but also to help them build capacity.
And getting into the details of the program, how can small business owners qualify? What does that process look like? And what is provided as a resource, both monetarily and also when it comes to other forms of support?
So I'll answer that first, if that's okay. So there's the full program, right? And so again, we are now going to act as a front door for small businesses for guidance around that technical assistance, that technical support. So really anybody that's looking to start or expand their business in Milwaukee County should be able to call us once we've onboarded our small business liaison and help to navigate, like, give me the first steps. Who do I talk to? What do I need to know to get started? And be that continual, like, single person that helps guide through that process. Then, like, the next level is And this is where we're going to more specialize is on those brick and mortar, those smaller commercial corridor brick and mortar spaces, helping them navigate that building out or that expansion. So when I talk about brick and mortar, those are our main streets. They're the hearts and souls of our neighborhoods. They tend to be smaller, mom and pop, mixed use. So, you know, National Avenue, North Avenue, like corridors like that are really great examples of where we're going to be partnering with the municipalities in navigating that permitting process.
The only thing I would add on to that is that, you know, I want people to understand that this is for all parts of Milwaukee County, right? It's not just for the city of Milwaukee. It's not just for Wauwatosa or Glendale or South Milwaukee and Franklin. We want to make sure that we have the opportunity to spread these businesses across the entire county, because we know that there are commercial corridors, quite frankly, has been empty, not just from COVID, but even prior to that. So we want to make sure that everybody understands we want this to spread across every corner of Milwaukee County.
Where does the inception for this program, where does that come from as far as the funding, the support? How is that able to be given back into the community?
So there was a fund here at Milwaukee County that was created almost a little over a decade ago from the sales of some of the real estate. And so Milwaukee County, our economic development has usually been in the form of selling real estate. And so the Board of Supervisors then said that we're going to create a fund basically for economic development from the sales of those lands. I hope you're keeping me true to this, Celia. So they sold that fund and it generated close to about $600,000. And so that $600,000 is what's going to provide the opportunity for us to bring on the business liaison and actually pay for those services. And we will revisit this after about 2 years to make sure the program is doing what it needs to do for a level of accountability. But we are also able to secure a $200,000 grant from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And so we decided one of the best ways for us to build even our capacity for economic development is to bring on this business liaison and couple that with those WEDC funds to help get dollars out the door.
And Eddie, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned also the grant program a little bit more in detail because you'd asked about that as well. So as a part of this larger small business building bridges program that we have, we do have those $200,000 that we're able to provide in grants of $10,000 to small businesses. And what we're looking for as far as eligibility is for active real estate projects. Where are they activating these commercial corridor spaces, whether it's through expansion or they're just starting up? And we need some level of confirmation around business acumen, right? Have they partnered with our partners or technical assistance providers to like really build themselves up for long-term success? And is there a letter of support from those entities as well as the municipality? Are they living and loving being in Milwaukee County, and is their business going to be in there? And so when it comes down to that, that's really all you need to be eligible for the grant specifically.
David, you mentioned revisiting the program after a year or two to check in. How will you evaluate its effectiveness? What are some of the short-term and long-term metrics to really gauge the effectiveness of the program?
Yeah, this was actually an amendment to the resolution that we had put forth with the county board. And this was actually put forth by County Supervisor Steve Taylor. And really, honestly, this is just about, it's about level of accountability. You know, what businesses are we working with? Are we identifying real businesses? And a lot of that is just to make sure that we understand as government, we have limited funds, limited access to funds. And I think this is just a way to make sure that we're not creating a position in perpetuity that won't necessarily provide the outcomes that we are looking for. But I have no doubt in my mind, when you think about the level of support many businesses are looking for here in the city of Milwaukee, in many cities and villages across Milwaukee County, that people are not going to be flocking for these level of services. And so we're going to be looking at, you know, what types of businesses that we're going to be giving dollars to, how quickly are we getting dollars out the door, and what kind of capacity do we really need with this program moving forward in order for it to be successful.
That was Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley and Economic Development Director Celia Benton. They join WUWM's Eddie Morales to talk about Milwaukee County's Building Bridges program. We've got a new season of Bulber Talk going, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and when we return, we'll talk with a local animal attorney about how a lawyer can help protect animal welfare. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Practicing animal law isn't as cute and cuddly as it sounds. Animal attorneys work to uphold state and federal laws that protect pets, wildlife, and animals used for food, entertainment, and research. May's issue of Milwaukee Magazine explores what animal law is and the types of cases local attorney Joe Good takes on. He joins Lake Effect's expert Nunez to share more.
For people who aren't familiar with the field of animal law, can you briefly explain what it is and how you became involved with this type of work?
First and foremost, every state in the United States and many, many municipalities within those states have a body of laws that protect animal welfare, right? We want to make sure animals are fed. We want to make sure that animals obtain water. We want to make sure that they're not housed outside when it's really cold or housed outside when it's really warm. We have a series of animal fighting laws covering various species. And the idea is in an organized society that we want to treat our animals with respect. And so very broadly speaking, animal law, animal welfare laws relate to how we interrelate with animals as human beings. How I got into it, long story. So I'm a trial lawyer here in Milwaukee. I do business-to-business disputes, do a lot of work in the franchise and dealership trade. In 2006, I was living in Madison working at a firm. I had a dear friend who was on the board of directors of the Dane County Humane Society, which is the shelter based in Madison, one of the oldest open source animal shelters in the United States. And they had a problem. They had inherited an impound of 62 pit bull dogs as part of a federal subpoena enforcement of a drug ring. And this fella, his name was Bob Lowry, was subject to this search warrant, and there were 62 pit bulls out on his farm, chained up, who actually, it turned out later, were part of a giant dogfighting ring that Lowry ran. So he was getting chased for drugs, and he was getting chased for that. The Humane Society took those dogs. They had a contract at the time with Dane County, and they were stuck, and they were trying to figure out what to do about it. And that's how I first got involved. I didn't know anything about it. It was baptism by fire.
It definitely seems like that. So this isn't something that you always envisioned yourself doing, is it?
No. I grew up with animals. I've always loved animals. I have a great deep respect for animals. And frankly, there are days where I think I like animals better than humans, particularly dogs. But no, I was kind of thrown into the deep end of the pool. I didn't set my sights out of law school to be involved in this kind of work. As a result of the Lowry case, which went to trial in the Dane County Circuit Court, and subsequent events, I joined the board of directors of the Dane County Humane Society, began to understand animal welfare better from that perspective, began to counsel municipalities around the state, animal shelters, veterinarians. I've done a lot of speaking and teaching at this point. So I kind of naturally, organically, and just grew as my experience grew.
And you spoke a bit about this animal welfare case. Are these the type of cases in animal law that you usually take on? And if so, how often do these cases come up?
So thankfully, we don't see many large, you know, seizure impoundment cases. Typically, they are of two stripes. The Lowry case was literally involved in animal fighting ring and in dogs that had been abused and were part of a fighting operation. More often what we see is large-scale animal seizures from municipalities involve hoarding situations where people with good intentions begin to take in animals, sometimes even as the designated rescue for a particular municipality, but they're under-resourced, they're understaffed, but because their basic mentality and approach is, I can save everything, they end up doing a very poor job saving anything. And, you know, abuse and neglect is not necessarily animal fighting, right, in the sense of doing intentional acts to engage animals in fighting, but it still can be very, very harmful to the welfare of the animals. So I would say since 2006, I've probably done seven large animal seizures around the state of Wisconsin. These are large-scale events. You know, they involve law enforcement. They involve humane officers. They involve shelters. They involve outside groups like the ASPCA and HSUS, because once you seize the animals, you have to have a place to place the animals, and the animals who are seized are owned by the person who is being subjected to the target and to the search and the potential, you know, criminal ramifications of their behavior. And so there's a civil piece to it. What do you do with the animals while mm-hmm. this matter's pending? And then, of course, there's the parallel criminal proceeding that's typically going on alongside of it.
So a lot of different parts. And you mentioned you're a trial attorney. What makes animal law different from the other types of law you practice? And is it trickier in any way?
I don't know if it's trickier. I mean, there is a complicating factor, because the way there's a set of Wisconsin statutes that govern animal welfare. Chapter 951 of the Wisconsin statutes is called Crimes Against Animals. And it literally lists the various things that our state legislature has decided are illegal. Some are misdemeanors, some are felonies, and includes animal fighting, as I said before, and abuse and neglect type situations. And what makes cases involving animals difficult, I think, to prosecute on the criminal side is that every animal has to be analyzed within the species of what's gone on. So you might have a dog who is dehydrated, who has been chained up improperly, right, and so on and so forth. There might be three or four criminal violations for each animal. So if you think about a large-scale animal seizure with perhaps hundreds of animals, mm-hmm. imagine the charging document for the prosecutor just to get through that. Right? So I think that's what kind of makes it unique. What I really like about it, you know, for me, it is, I would say side gig's probably the wrong word, but it's kind of a place to express some joy, to do some real good. Like all the animal cases I've been involved in, they're often emotionally fraught, very complex at times in terms of the personalities involved, but it's kind of assuring as a human to do good things for animals.
Yeah, I could totally understand that. And are there any animal law cases you're currently or recently worked on that you can tell me a little bit about?
So, you know, it's actually been a dry spell, which I think is a good thing, right? I haven't been doing a lot of large scale work. Some of that is, you know, my intake and inflow is really based on my day job, right, in terms of my availability and the like. But I haven't been involved in a seizure probably in 4 or 5 years in terms of consulting in this space. And I kind of like that, because what that says is maybe we as a state, we as a series of structured units within the state are doing better, right, with these things, trying to nip in the bud bad behavior before bad behavior becomes catastrophic behavior for animals in these situations.
And I wonder, too, for our listeners, how popular is this field of animal law nationally and just in our state?
Sure. I mean, you should talk to my friend Megan Senatori, who teaches at Lewis and Clark Law School in Oregon. She's a former lawyer like me in private practice. I think Megan and I are the only people in the state of Wisconsin in private practice who had done this kind of work, again, not full time, but as part of what our professional makeup was about. My understanding is animal law is burgeoning in all of the law schools mm-hmm. as a course topic, which I think is pretty awesome, right? You can't get anywhere in this world without awareness, you know, and knowing, you know, what are the rules and what's out there. And what I have found with the young lawyers and law students that I've integrated with in some of these situations, they're very passionate, right? It's pretty easy to get behind animals, in my view. And the people who go into this do so because they're substantively very convinced that they can do better for our society and help.
Hmm. So are there any misconceptions of animal law that you sometimes come across?
Sure. I think one of the big problems that we face, and this is a national problem, but let's just speak to the direct experiences I've had in this state. I find many municipalities in this state, many elected actors in this state, have a tendency to treat animal welfare issues, that's a broad statement, with kind of a secondary class attitude. I've done a lot of teaching for DATCAP up in the state. I teach one of their humane officer certification segments each year. And I always say this to the class, which is filled with humane officers-to-be and law enforcement officers who are being pegged by their municipality to do animal control, animal welfare. My view of it as a society is it's no different than being sure we have clean roads in the winter and that the garbage is picked up, because we as an organized society want to treat things a certain way. We want to make sure we have clean streets and safe streets, right? We want to make sure we don't have burgeoning garbage problems around. Animal control should be treated the same way. The problem with that is there are a lot of municipalities in this state who, let's just say, they treat it as a secondary concern.
Right. And before we wrap up, I want to end on this note. You know, animal law only makes up a small part of your practice, but it's definitely not easy. What motivates you to do this type of work?
Have you ever seen a dog smile? It's pretty easy, right? I mean, when you see animals who have gone from a beleaguered situation, who by the grace of God or the grace of something get out of that situation, you know, people who are engaged, rolling up their sleeves and extricating them from bad situations, and you see them 6 months later, it's very, very worthwhile to watch what happens.
Right. Their lives are changing.
Correct.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed learning more about the work that you do.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Joe Good is a Milwaukee trial attorney who was featured in May's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. His practice spans several specialties, including animal law. He joined LegFX Excret Nunez. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of LegFX this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the LegFX podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on LegFX, we'll learn about recent cuts to programs at the 16th Street Health Clinics. Plus, we'll learn about the funding cuts Planned Parenthood is facing and how it could impact care. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.